Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Modis, and I'm your host, a Filipino-American, native New Yorker, current California transplant, bulldog mama, and an uncommon occupational therapist myself for the past 22 years. On this podcast, you will hear me proudly feature the unique careers of occupational therapy practitioners working in non-traditional and role-emerging practice areas, settings where OT is uncommon. Be inspired as you listen to these up-close conversations and be energized and motivated to follow in these unconventional paths. Happy listening, friends. So I'm thrilled to introduce you to our guest of honor today. Her name is Kiara Smith. Kiara is a pediatric pelvic health therapist and has been a practicing occupational therapist for over 11 years in both California and in Hawaii. She has worked in various settings, including hospitals, schools, and equine centers, providing hippotherapy as a treatment tool and outpatient clinics. Her pediatric experience encompasses serving infants, toddlers, children, and adolescents with various medical conditions and diagnoses. Realizing the social, emotional, and psychological challenges that pelvic floor dysfunction places on children and families, Kiara decided to niche down her private practice to exclusively treating children and adolescents with pelvic floor dysfunction and toileting challenges. Kiara utilizes a holistic and integrative approach to pediatric pelvic floor dysfunction. She partners with her canine assistant, Nellie, a Labrador Golden Retriever cross, in guiding children toward continence with confidence. So to tell us a little bit more about that, without further ado, I'd like to present to you Kiara Smith. Welcome, Kiara.
Hello, Patricia. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Super excited to have you on the show, my fellow Pinay sister. For our listeners out there, I want you to know that Kiara and I are both Filipinas, and yeah, we sort of share that common bond. So we were just speaking before the show about my excitement for bringing her on the show and really inspiring other Filipino OTs out there.
Yeah, and that's what I love about kind of this connection where social media can really bring together practitioners of color and women of color, especially OTs who are Pacific Islanders, Asian American Pacific Islanders, and really showcasing our work and our practices.
Yes. So thank you so much for taking the time. I'm excited to hear more about your specialty. Pelvic floor dysfunction is the issue that you're dealing with, and the specialty is called pelvic health.
Yes, correct. And that's pediatric pelvic health. So pelvic floor dysfunction can happen throughout anyone's lifetime, but we don't often hear about it in children. And yes, it makes sense because children do have reproductive organs. They do have a digestive and urinary system, and things can go awry. And so I didn't even know about pelvic floor dysfunction in children when I was in graduate school. We didn't learn anything about it per se, but it was only until I worked in a specialty children's hospital that I really started to learn and dive deep into this area of difficulties for children. Mm-hmm. And I was able to train with a senior therapist who was providing this service. And I just fell in love with the population because, number one, they were underserved. There was not enough providers in the area to be able to help them and support them and their families. And number two, there were things that I was already doing in my practice and in my personal life with holistic and integrative approaches like mindfulness and yoga and other things that were helpful in the intervention process to help these children with their toileting issues.
Got it. Wow. I love that you are able to, you know, really sort of hone in on a niche or a need here, right? And a population that's underserved. Were you always a pelvic health therapist prior to specializing in pediatrics?
That's a great question. And the answer is no. I had no idea what pelvic health was. I wasn't a mother yet at that time. And often we think about women's health and women that have had babies or, other medical conditions that would require someone to go have pelvic floor therapy. But I wasn't a pelvic floor therapist. I wasn't a women's therapist. I was just a strictly outpatient pediatric therapist that worked with feeding, sensory processing, fine motor, all the kind of general stuff that you would see in an outpatient clinic. And then I also worked with infants as well for developmental type of things. And so this was just a small area of the organization that they had an opportunity for me to train and be able to learn a new skill if I wanted to. And I am so happy that I was afforded the opportunity to do that because that's how I got into the work.
That's super important to know because these opportunities come in a variety of ways, right? And oftentimes it's really through fieldwork experiences or, already in your existing work setting, right? If they're providing continuing education and such. And it's just so great to hear that that was available to you, and here you are.
Yes, absolutely. And I was able to get the training on the job as an employee, but within that position, I, took many continuing education courses to gain my skills in understanding pelvic floor dysfunction and how to treat children because children are not mini adults. And so you can be a pelvic floor therapist who works with adults, but you don't necessarily know how to work with children. And so I think for me, my background was really wonderful because I was a pediatric OT first, and then I learned pelvic health secondly. And I think that really helped me and my patients grow and have a wonderful rapport and be able to make gains over time.
This is so enlightening to me, and I think it will be for our listeners too, particularly those who are pediatric therapists out there who may be thinking of bridging into another subspecialty, right? Which is exactly what you did.
Yes, absolutely. Just like there's a subspecialty of feeding, neonatal care, hand therapy, vision. There's this new and emerging area for OTs, and that's what I'm really excited about, that there is new therapists out there who are learning the skills to treat pediatric pelvic floor dysfunction as an OT with an OT lens. Because we have the developmental and sensory background, we're so very well equipped to be able to serve these kids and these families.
Oh gosh. That is amazing. So, all right, let's take a couple of steps back. I know here we are, we're talking about, where you are today, and I definitely want to dig deeper into that and perhaps have you talk to us a little bit about a typical session. But before we do, please tell us a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about, I don't know, OT school, things that happened after OT school that sort of led you to where you are now.
Yeah, so I went to Samuel Merritt University, which is located in Oakland, California, for my master's degree in occupational therapy. And then I really wanted to be a pediatric OT in a specialty children's hospital in acute care. But at that time, the requirements were that you had to have at least 5 years of experience, excuse me, of acute care work or being a therapist for 5 years. And so I thought, oh, what am I going to do then? And so during my level twos, I was able to get a job after passing my boards for Stanford Hospital and UCSF. So I worked for both organizations. I was a student for both. They wanted me to work for them. And they said, please come and work for us once you pass your boards. And so I split time between both organizations because I really loved both
Oh,
settings.
great.
So I was an acute care therapist there after being a level two student. And it was really wonderful. And I say that because The level two placements are a wonderful opportunity for students to really dive deep into their skill sets and their clinical reasoning with the support of an experienced clinician. And so, if you have a really good fit in terms of what you want to do as a therapist once you graduate, and you already have that training from an organization that respects your work, respects you as a person, and can help develop you as a therapist, then it's a wonderful match
It
because you've already
is.
spent time there. So I really do firmly believe in those fieldwork placements as a wonderful part of the curriculum for schools, and students, and just the OT profession in general. But like I said, I started in acute care. And then I was there for a year, and then I moved to Hawaii, where I continued acute care in a urban hospital, working with all different types of conditions and diagnoses, from trauma to neuro ICU, burns, strokes, everything under the sun. And so I was in Honolulu, and there's only a few hospitals that are trauma or level three or four hospitals for the whole state. So we are seeing a large amount of cases, not only of the local population throughout the state that would get flown in from different islands, but also tourists. So that was another component of my work there, but also being in a very diverse work environment where the majority of the colleagues that I had and also my patients were of Asian American or Pacific Islander descent, which was different from when I was in the Bay Area. The Bay Area was very diverse, but there was more diversity and different cultures when I was at Stanford and UCSF than in Honolulu, Hawaii, where the majority of the people there, like I mentioned, are from Asian American descent or Pacific Islander or Native Hawaiians. So that was a wonderful experience of just being an immersed culture and understanding and embracing diversity, equity, and inclusion, because that's a huge part of what we can strive to improve in our profession. And being able to work in that environment was really wonderful. And then after a few years there, we moved back to California. And that's when I got the opportunity to work at Stanford Children's Hospital, which was my dream job and where I learned all the skills to be able to help me navigate into my own private practice where I exclusively treat pediatric pelvic floor patients now.
Got it. Oh, wow. I love the trajectory that your career took. And it really sounds like each of these experiences, right, even though they were not all in the pediatric realm, really added to your ability to really be able to start your own thing.
Absolutely. And I would not trade my experience for anything. I wouldn't take it back. The first year that I was on my own as a new grad in an acute care, urban, fast-paced setting as UCSF and Stanford, I learned more in that 1 year of practice than I think I've learned in like the 10 years of practice. It's just a different type of learning. But those foundational skills I know prepared me and made me confident in being able to navigate new areas of specialty work, and also kind of stretch my imagination and be able to go for thinking outside of the box and looking at OT entrepreneurship. Because if you would have told me 12 years ago that I'd be my own business owner, I'd say, yeah, right. I'd be working for an organization who's giving me benefits, telling me, what I need to see and what I need to do. And I'm going to be there for, till I'm 65. But that wasn't my journey. And I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to be able to go into the OT entrepreneurship because it was something I think deep down wanted to do, but I didn't have enough courage, I think, until I gained enough experience and competency as a therapist. And then when I became a mother, that was the biggest push to shift into this new space and this new role. as a business owner and a woman of color in this specialty area of practice.
Oh, so amazing again how you ended up where you are. Thanks for sharing with us just, you know, what brought you here. I find it remarkable to hear about OTs just really working in so many different types of settings, right? So many different types of populations and how that varies throughout your career, because we really do evolve as therapists. So I love where you've evolved into. And yeah, I'm looking forward to, you know, hear more about your future evolution after this, because I think that you're just one to keep taking on challenges. And I love, you know, I emphasize that because, again, with the skill set that we have as OTs, we're well equipped for those challenges.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think when you become an OT and you commit your life to a service of others, there is a kind of authenticity about wanting to serve and help people, but also to wanting to develop yourself. Mm-hmm. And it might not be clear in the beginning. And I think it's just an evolving practice over time as life goes on and as you grow as a person and opportunities come and go and people come and go into your life. It presents itself the journey to build trust, but also to see where else your path can lead if you mm-hmm. have courage, enough courage. And when one door opens, another door closes, and so on and so forth. I'm such a believer in synchronicity and the universe. And when we're ready, the doors open for us. And we can embrace in that and we can have grace in it.
So we talked, you know, a little bit about your background. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. A little bit about what path you took and kind of what led you to where you are today. Can you now describe to us a little bit about your practice, your business, your uncommon OT work? Perhaps, you know, give us an example of a typical sort of day, a typical session, or a typical client that you might have and some needs that you might address with them.
Absolutely. So my practice is called Aloha Integrative Therapy. And like you mentioned, I treat children as young as 4 all the way up to 18 years old who have bowel and bladder dysfunction or toileting challenges. The most common diagnoses I see in my practice are constipation, bedwetting, toilet refusal, toilet anxiety, sensory differences impacting toileting or bowel and bladder management, and the list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And right now, I would say that 90% of my cases are on telehealth. So I am able to treat and evaluate patients and clients over telehealth. And it's been a wonderful kind of shift because mm-hmm. I've noticed when the child and the family are in their own environment, there's a different sense of the nervous system regulation, mm-hmm. meaning that they're more open. The child is more comfortable. Yeah. They might see me over the screen, of course, but their parent is the one doing the hands-on work. Uh-huh. And it's been wonderful in that respect. And I actually really believe that it builds the confidence of the child with the caregiver's like abilities, mm-hmm. because the parent has to, or the caregiver has to do the hands-on work or get the child in a certain position or tell me what they're seeing or what they're feeling when I'm having them do assessments. So that's been a really wonderful kind of evolution of my practice. The other 10%, I would see them in my clinic. And so a typical evaluation will say the mm-hmm. child comes in with their family. And before they come in, the family will tell them, we're going to see this woman and this is her. So there's a preparation activity that I have all parents and families go through before they have a meeting with me or a session mm-hmm. with me. Because oftentimes these children who are having these challenges have that anxiety. Yeah. And so having them prepared and getting their nervous system like ready to see me or talk to me, it helps the process tenfold. And so the
I
parent will
love
show up.
it.
Yeah, the parent will show a picture of Nellie and I and say, "This is Kiara. She helps kids who are having trouble with their body. Sometimes their body's not listening to them. Like, sometimes the stuff that happens at school with you, well, she helps 5-year-olds just like you who are having these leaks happen during the day. And she's there to figure out why. And she has a really kind dog who helps kids too." And so there's just,
I love it.
yeah, so there's just this really appropriate developmental communication going on and understanding cognition. How old is this child? What are they able to understand? And what are we going to do to be able to create rapport and a sense of trust and security, even with the
Yes.
conversation of what's going on in the body?
Absolutely. I love
Yeah.
that you brought up the safety, right? That the child or one a person, right, would need to feel to have conversations about one's bowel movement or just one's difficulties, surrounding that, right? There's a certain level of shame, I'm guessing, or just kind of not having the words, perhaps, right? So I love your approach. I love how thoughtful it is, and how, you're off to a good start already, in my opinion, when someone walks into a room and is feeling more centered and grounded, perhaps thanks to Nelly, right? But obviously, it's also their own skills that they've built, and
Absolutely.
how, I absolutely love that. And, setting them up for a more successful session with you, right? A more open, a more a session that would more likely be more just effective, because they'll open up, they'll feel safer too, right? Their guard is down. I absolutely believe the power of having animals assist you in our work, right? It's their mind. It's mind blowing, the unspoken rapport that they're able to build with our, with some of the most difficult clients. They just sort of exude, this energy that, people really respond to, and people in our industry find super healing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, as an OT and looking at the environment, how I set up my clinic is very intentional, right? So I set up a space that's very open. I have Himalayan salt lamps. I have aromatherapy diffusers. I'm using different types of plant and flower medicine to be able to have this space be as clear and good energy, a lot of natural light. I do a lot of, feng shui placement of furniture and just the intentionality of that. And also, when people are coming into my space, that they're taking a pause. So, before coming into the space, they take their shoes off. I ring a bell. They're invited to come in. They clean their hands and then we begin. So, it's a very routine kind of thing that I start to build, but it's because. Because it helps people's expectations. I know every time I see Miss Kiara, this is what we're going to do. And it makes the child gain more safety and more trust with me. And so that's a big part of the environment. And as an OT, we look at these things and we know that environment plays such a huge role in performance. And so that's another big part of my practice. And then I also would invite them into the evaluation. We talk about toileting patterns. We look at posture. We look at retained primitive reflexes. I assess their sensory system. We look at pelvic floor control, and that's all external if the child is open to doing that. And we talk about consent. What does it mean when someone's asking you to maybe take off your undergarments or taking a look, or and we talk about that based on how old the child is and cognitively how they're able to understand there's always a parent or caregiver in the room at all times when we're doing any kind of intervention, especially when it's around the pelvic floor, but
Yes.
nothing is internal. So that's the difference between adult pelvic health and children pelvic health, is there's no internal assessments or internal interventions that I do with children. It's
Got
only
it.
on the surface. So I would ask them, you know, show me what it looks like when you don't want to have a poop come out, and I just take a peek and see what their external muscles are doing, and it gives me a good understanding of kind of what's happening. And we also have fancy machines that can be used, like a biofeedback machine or an ultrasound machine, depending on if that's a great intervention tool for the child's specific condition.
Oh, got it. What would you need an ultrasound machine for in some cases?
So the ultrasound machine is a really good tool to see if children are having post-void residual. So meaning that there's urine left in the bladder, maybe they're not emptying, and that's causing some of the urinary stress incontinence they might be experiencing. Or it can also show us how full of stool they are in real time. And so we can look at the ultrasound and see if there's stool burden pushing on that bladder. And we can also see how distended, how widened that rectum is if they have had chronic constipation, because that will cause decreased sensation and fecal leakage, as well as putting pressure on the bladder for urinary incontinence.
Got it. So is that part of the standard assessment, or that's something that you do when only when needed, when called
Yeah,
for?
only when needed, because it's a little bit more, I would say, complicated for some kids to understand what that is. And typically they don't want to be touched in that way, or they don't want specific machines because they're scared. But it can be super helpful for kids who are open to it and parents who are open to it. But it's not a standard evaluation
Okay,
tool.
got it. So, wow. Again, I would love for every OT session, regardless of whether it's with children or not, or in pelvic health, right, to be exactly like the sessions that you described, to be as thoughtful, right? We're looking at everything, the environment, the lighting, what the room smells like as you walk in, right? Because the reality is that it affects everything, or it has an effect. So again, I love the thoughtfulness in your work, and particularly in how you're serving these children. You know, I was just starting to think about, wow, I wonder what kinds of assistance or support they received prior. I'm not sure if you knew about that, and if that's what sort of inspired you. I know pediatrics was something that was always in your expertise and sort of a love of yours, right? But then specializing in this type of dysfunction, and particularly with children.
Yeah. And I think it was just the right fit. Like, all the stars aligned for me to be able to learn about the skill set and enjoy it and grow and develop as a clinician in this space. But I really think that the dysfunction that I was seeing in the clinic when I first started off really made me try and figure out, how can I prevent some of this to happen? Meaning, how can I prevent these kids from even having to see me when things have gone so bad? And I was doing research and trying to figure out, and it just kept coming back to a few things. And one being, the dysfunction started happening when kids were going through the potty training process. So they either started very early, or they've had issues with chronic constipation, withholding, UTIs, that sort of thing, when they were going through that learning process. And I wanted to create kind of an approach to help give parents a resource to be able to get on the right foot that's based out of child development and pelvic health. And you see a lot of, you know, potty training protocols and books and all that kinds of things out there, but it's not necessarily rooted from a place of a medical expert who has seen the dysfunction. And so what I did was create a potty training course with Tinyhood, which is a parent online education company, that is a self-paced course for parents to basically try and get on the best right foot possible when supporting their child through this developmental milestone, in hopes that it supports their pelvic health throughout childhood so they never have to step into a clinic like mine and see me.
Oh, congratulations on that course.
Thank you. Yeah. And that's available now. And it just became available earlier this month. So it's gotten wonderful reviews, and it's a step-by-step process by which parents can feel good about the process of supporting children's pelvic health. And I will say that a lot of the issues that we're seeing lately in pelvic floor dysfunction are tied to sensory differences, gut health, attention, and the lack of movement. And so this is a lot of the things that pediatric OTs and even pediatric PTs are coming across with their patients. They're saying, you know, in the intake forms, mom and dad are complaining about the kids are having more accidents, or they've never been continent. They're still wearing a pull-up and they're 7 years old. And is this normal? And so there's this kind of undetected, I think underreported, I should say, underreported symptoms that parents go to their pediatric providers and, you know, nonchalantly say, oh yeah, like he pees his bed maybe every other night or whatever. And the doctor says it's okay. And sometimes that's dismissive, and that's actually gaslighting for a lot of parents that start to work with me, and they say, what these providers are doing are telling me that it's my child's behavioral issue, or that they'll grow out of it, or just keep giving them more medication. And so, but they've been doing that for years with no change. And so there's not enough providers like myself who are pediatric pelvic floor specialists that are around the United States that are easily accessible for these parents to reach out to. And so I'm hoping that, you know, the OT and PT schools and curriculum will start to incorporate some of this into the education.
Yes. And, you know, I hope that our listeners will find that inspiring and motivating in this sense, right? It's, you know, you also have been, you mentioned to me that you offer mentorship.
Yeah, absolutely. I offer mentorship to those therapists who are looking to get into this space. And then I also offer a holistic and integrative pediatric pelvic health course. It's an online course that's about 6 hours long that gives you the fundamentals to start treating these kids tomorrow, if you wanted to, in a framework by which you can start supporting them and getting them the resources they need. And I always tell providers, I say, you don't have to do what I do, and don't do it the way I do it, because I am not the expert whatsoever. I'm always learning. I'm continually growing. But there's things that you have within your own toolbox already and your experiences that can help these families if you know just some basic foundational things. And if you're noticing these symptoms, you can say, hey, actually, I've heard about that. I've read about it. I know I should refer this child to a pediatric GI doctor, or I should be able to give them a list of medications as part of education to say, hey, these medications that your child is having are for this, that maybe your pediatrician doesn't know about these. And so it's just these ways that we can be resources and not necessarily white horses who are going to save the day all the time to be able to support kids and families that really need our help.
Yeah, it sounds like we're facilitating conversations that weren't happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for those examples, you know, really kind of taking us through. After the evaluation, can you talk to us about some sessions? What, how many sessions does it typically take to work with a child? Anything more you can share? Are you doing, not sure if you're doing groups or parent support groups or anything like that?
Yeah. So that's been one of the things that parents are asking. They're like, oh, it'd be so great, Kiara, if you did a support group, but I'm not doing that currently. I do individual sessions after the evaluation. So once I've looked at all the different systems and seeing what is happening and what potentially could be the root cause of some of these challenges, then I really have a clear and actionable step by which I start implementing strategies for the families to follow. Mm-hmm. And we do weekly sessions for the first 6 weeks, because we know that change can be elicited within that time frame, and I should be able to see some progress, right? As yes. a therapist, we want to see small gains. We're working on improvements. And in that time frame, these parents are looking at how their child's body patterns are, how are they implementing different things of changes in diet and fluid intake, looking at their mm-hmm. supplements, supports, and medications, looking at how their neuromuscular system is working the child's in terms of their exercises that I've prescribed, and then looking at outcomes, like, are they having less leaks? Are they feeling more urge? What is the functional goals that they have, and are they meeting or getting close to those? Mm-hmm. And then after that, once they've hit that 6 week mark, we taper down to maybe every other week. Sometimes it's every once a month. It mm-hmm. just depends on how the child is progressing. And I will say, the older, longer the dysfunction, the longer the treatment plan, mm-hmm. right? Because yeah. it's already been in their motor pattern already.
Yes.
And so we're trying to unwind the nervous system, but also neuromuscularly, how can we make those changes?
Yes.
And so that's kind of how I work in that treatment planning. And I also provide parent coaching. So mm. for parents that are not in the states that I'm licensed to provide direct OT services, I do parent education. So it's really figuring out, okay, where are you now and what kind of strategies can we implement? But it's not such a dictated treatment or care plan that someone with, you know, OT medical services would have.
Yeah, I love that. That's brilliant. A typical session involves the parent and the child, right?
So absolutely.
I'm have a visual of the virtual session and the sort of in-person session would yeah. be, and both parties are there. So I guess, you know, a typical session would be how long?
Yeah, a typical session would be a 60-minute in length session, but 50 to 45 minutes is spent just with the parent. So I'm just working with the parent and giving them education, showing them how to do maybe visceral mobilization on the child. Maybe I'm having them bring the child into certain therapeutic exercises, looking at posture on the toilet, looking at mm-hmm. breath work. They're doing everything hands-on with the child. And then maybe 15 to 10 minutes, I'm talking directly to the child. I'm reading a book. I'm playing a game with Nelly. We're talking about their body. And so in that way, they're still hearing me when I'm working with the parent, and they're still actively participating.
Yes.
And it also depends on how old the child is and what their cognitive level is and, mm-hmm. and their attention skills. And so each session is very unique based on the person I have in front of me.
Yes.
And it's very customized and it's very intentional. And mm-hmm. so that's the biggest, I think, focus, is to be able to give parents those actionable steps to take immediately and not mm-hmm. to overwhelm them. So like the first treatment session is really giving them the basic education and then fine tuning as the weeks mm-hmm. go by. You trial this, you do this, you come back next week and this happens. And there is a commitment and a responsibility in the relationship I have with the family
yes.
and the caregiver. They understand that my time is precious and I understand their time is precious, and we honor that. Mm-hmm. And if you are not able to commit to this type of work together, where it's very active and it's very, has to be very consistent, mm-hmm. then it might not be the right time to work together, or this might not be the right fit.
Yeah.
And so this is what's really wonderful about being my own, provider and my own boss in a way, because I have my own practice, mm-hmm. that I can make those discerning choices to say, who can I best serve with my knowledge and with their skills?
Yes.
And I don't want to waste anyone's time or resources. And I want to be direct and transparent. And it has been a wonderful way to practice in that way.
Mm-hmm. The perks of entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah.
Being your own boss, creating your own schedule, yeah. and really seeing any client or not that you choose.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, it sounds to me that, you know, you were also speaking to readiness, right? In terms of the parents being ready to make this commitment, because they're obviously a big part of the treatment plan, right? So thank you for emphasizing the importance, or I guess just the weight of parent education in your work.
And I think it's not only just the education, but it's the support. I don't know how many times parents have told me, Kiara, you are my accountability person. Like, I know that next week I'm going to have the session with you and you're going to ask me the same questions and you're going to hold me accountable. And you're going to ask me, like, how am I really doing? And you can tell if I'm not doing well or if things are going or they are going well. And I appreciate that from you. And I think, you know, there has to be that one person that parents really believe has their back and knows that they're doing the best they can for their child. Because oftentimes I feel like healthcare providers, unseemingly or unknowingly, don't make that apparent when they have the, you know, 15-minute well child visit or whatever, like email correspondence, and it's short and it's broken and it doesn't seem very supportive. And I think just being able to have and hold this space for this particular type of family who's going through these really challenging things with continence in their child, it really gives them that space to be like just completely themselves and say, like, this is hard. Like, I need your help, and like being vulnerable to that. And then having me be able to say, okay, I can see that, and I'm trying to support you. How can we partner together to do this?
Yeah, it's a collaboration. So how do these parents find you?
So before I moved and before COVID, I had a wait list in the Silicon Valley. The providers there knew what I did when I went into private practice. And then we moved from the Silicon Valley to the North Bay in Santa Rosa, which is in Sonoma County. And then COVID hit. So I didn't know anyone in that area. And so a business consultant said, well, no one knows about you because you don't have anything. You know, like you have a website maybe, but it's like that's not even that great. And you know, there's nothing on social media. There's, you know, you don't have anything. So how are people going to find you? So I said, oh goodness. I don't know if I want to do this whole social media thing. I don't know how to do it. You know, I'm a clinician. Like I could see my patients. I can do that. But I really had to get comfortable with the uncomfortable and look at it as just another way to support families. Because if they don't know what I know in my brain, it's not going to do anything to help them in their moment of need or their children's lives. So by goodness, let's do that Instagram page. Sure, you tell me how to do it and I'll do it. And I just started learning how to do some of the things of, you know, social media. And I was soon off to a pretty good start with some help.
Ah, great. Well, I'm, number one, way to pivot, right? Through the pandemic. And number two, I'm personally thrilled you started an Instagram page, because that's how you and I met.
Yeah, I've met so many wonderful people. I can't even tell you how many wonderful opportunities and just kids and parents' lives that I've been able to help in so many ways that it's been just overwhelmingly such a loving experience, really, one of gratitude and appreciation for the good things in life, you know, and having that ability to share a gift with those that could really use it.
Sounds like a true win-win situation, where you're serving such an important need and you're also serving yourself, right? And your own sort of professional aspirations. I think
Absolutely.
that's really important too. All right. So thank you for sharing all of that. Processing a lot of it still. Can we switch gears a little bit to money matters? I know we talked
Absolutely.
about how to, where you get your referrals, how do folks find you, how do they pay? you? Do you accept insurance? Is this a model that you follow?
So I do not accept insurance directly. I provide super bills for the patients that I am registered and licensed to treat in, which is the states of Hawaii, California, and North Dakota. And so they pay through a electronic medical record platform that collects payments and does all my scheduling, which makes it really wonderful. And they pay for the knowledge and they invest in the transformation.
Yes. Now, you said that you provided super bills. Is this something that insurance would cover otherwise?
Yeah, so most insurances work differently, but what I do is provide the information prior to a patient scheduling a OT evaluation or a treatment session so they can see what might be covered through their insurance before booking with CPT codes, ICD-10 codes, treatment codes. So I give them all that knowledge so they're equipped to be able to speak to an insurance representative and get that real-time information. And then for the parent coaching sessions, those are not reimbursed by insurance or super bill, so that's an investment that is out of pocket. And
Got it.
sometimes they will use a FSA or HSA account.
Okay. So good to know again for listeners out there who are considering where funding might come from,
Yeah.
right? Are there any common myths or misconceptions about the work that you do that you'd like to demystify today?
I think there's a misconception about when people observe a treatment session and it looks like the children are just playing with a therapist. And so the misconception is that they're not just playing, but play is the occupation of a child. And so within that occupation or within that session, a pediatric therapist is working through so many different things. They're looking at sensory, they're looking at fine motor, they're looking at neuromuscular control, posture, all these things. And you have to make it engaging to a child. And through play, that's how you elicit that active participation and those opportunities to build skill. So play is not just play. I'm going to
Yes.
say that. Another thing about pelvic health, I think to demystify, is that it can be done with children, right? So they're
Yep.
like, well, how is that going to happen? It's the way that we use and communicate with words, how we're cueing kids. So take, for instance, how you would cue belly breathing or diaphragmatic breathing or trying to do 360 breathing. Maybe for an adult, you say, take a big inhale through your nose, fill the belly with your breath, hold for a count of three and slowly exhale out of your mouth with pursed lips breathing. Let me demonstrate that for you, right? But for a kid, you have to understand that playfulness and that play is super important. So what I might say is, let's figure out what color is your favorite color glitter. So when you breathe in this rose that I'm holding here, we're going to breathe in that color glitter air. And we're going to fill our bellies with that glitter. And we're going to hold for three, two, one, and you're going to blow it out like you're blowing a birthday candle, and all the glitter air is going to go all over the room and cover me and Nellie, right? Very different
Yes.
than taking a big inhale through the nose and exhaling, right? So that might be for a person who is seeing kids for pelvic health and they're cueing in that way, and then they're saying, well, the kid can't get that. Well, it's because you're not talking in kid language. And
Yes.
so that is the difference, I think, too, between being a really good pelvic health provider for children, and understanding those nuances.
I love that you added that because, I mean, come on. You're working with kids. You need their buy-in for you to get them to do anything, right? And what you just, the example that you just gave us was a beautiful example of how you engage a child in breath work, right? Without them really knowing it. So thank you for that great example. I kind of did the exercise myself and felt a little more grounded after.
Oh, wonderful.
But wow, these are such great tidbits that you're sharing with us. How about some career advice? I know our listeners are waiting for that, particularly those with an interest in the subspecialty. So thanks for sharing with us how you got to where you are. Lessons learned, right? Years later, what career advice would you offer OTs, OTPs out there who are interested in branching into this specialty?
Some advice I would give is to look at other practitioners who are doing what you think you would like to be doing and seeing kind of what their journey has been, maybe what their trainings have been, where what books they've read or courses that they've taught or attended or TA'd for. And kind of do start doing your research on that, having a journal or a Google Doc where you're kind of putting all this information into a database where you can slowly kind of have your data in one area to look at and see if this is an area that you'd really like to go into. And then reach out to that person. You never know, you can say, hey, I'm really interested in your work and I would really like to know more. Do you have any resources on your website or do you offer mentorship? And we have to remember that people are busy, right? So there's ways that we can be compensated or compensate this mentor in ways that could be really supportive for both the
Both.
relationship. And also having just conversations with some of the professors, maybe that you had in your coursework to see what other options, because they're really tightly networked with each other, and more than not, they're going to know people that know people. So, really having those networking opportunities are going to be a wonderful kind of asset in developing, your practice field. And then being open to opportunities too, exploring things and not saying no right away or not saying yes right away, but having some discernment in, okay, what is this opportunity? What can it do for me? Or what can it not do for me or hinder me from or whatever? And really having that evaluation of those things, because sometimes it seems so like great, like, of course, yes, I'll do it, but we don't really think it through and look at all the different moving parts. And if there's not an opportunity yet, this is another piece of advice. If there's not an opportunity yet that is in maybe an organization that you really want to work for or a department that you're really looking into, that you just don't keep that door closed. You just have it always open in your mind visually. This is what I did when I worked all the places before I landed into my job at Stanford Children's Hospital. I said, one day I'm going to work for that place. And I don't know if it's going to be in a year or two or three or five. And it happened to be after 5 years. And then I got the job because I always said, that is something I know that I can do and I'm going to do it, but I also have to be very proactive. I need to reach out to the supervisor. I need to make connections. I need to really do all these things to give me the best chance. And I think also too, being a woman of color, this is a very important thing that I want people to understand is that oftentimes we're not given the opportunities and we're not given the open door. It's we have to bang on the door multiple times and we have to be louder than everyone else and showcase our skills more than another person because of our background. And I really hope that things start to change and that it's not going to be like that forever because it's very sad, but it's also not fair. And there's just a lot of things to uncover with that sort of thing. But I would encourage the BIPOC community, people of color, practitioners of color, to not silence your voice. And you have a seat at the table, and you will make yourself a seat at the table if you work hard, because nothing's going to be handed to you. And that's just the reality of our world today.
Oh, such great advice you've given us. Particularly, the piece about representation, the piece about just willingness to explore, right? Also willingness to represent. And checking in with your professors, right? And, you know, I'm learning that most professors are really dabbling into some kind of uncommon, non-traditional work on the side.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, my experience lately. So I, you know, very much agree with that particular advice too. So thank you. Those are such great tidbits again that you gave us, and I think will be super helpful to our listeners who are interested in, you know, following your path. If any of them wanted to reach out to you or might be interested in mentorship, how do they find you? Is it okay for them to reach out?
Absolutely. They can find me on Instagram at Aloha Integrative Therapy. And you can also find me on my website. There's a lot of information there. I have a blog. I have a lot of information about what I do and my work. And that's at www.alohaintegrativetherapy.com. And you can also just shoot me an email. There is a portion on that website that you can send a direct email there.
Got it. We will have all of that information, your resources, your mentorship program, your courses. We'll have all of that stuff listed on along with our show notes. And I just want to thank you again one more time for joining us and for sharing your OT journey with us. You know, I want to congratulate you in just finding this really meaningful work, right? I think that's also another, you know, another piece to all of this. It's one thing to find a group of people who really use your service. And then it's one thing to, you know, really kind of enjoy the work too. But when you're kind of bridging two passions, it just brings about, you know, something different. And I hear that all over the place in your story. So I just really appreciate you taking the time to share and to inspire.
Thank you so much for all your wonderful work and your wonderful comments and thoughtfulness. I really appreciate that. And I just hope that, you know, whoever's listening to this, if you had a few gems to take away from it, that is wonderful.
Oh, I'm sure they will. You have shared so many great bits. And you know, again, it's coming from your own personal experiences, right? And, you know, they're all different, but then there's consistencies that I hear from one episode to the next, even though these are all OTs working in a variety of, you know, settings, right? And one that, you know, you mentioned also is connecting. Connect with others out there. So this is an open opportunity. And, you know, I'm not sure if you've heard me always sort of ask the guests, is it okay for our listeners to reach out to you? Because I want you to say it, right? I want our listeners to hear that it's okay for them to reach out, because I'm finding that OTs are also shy and, you know, may not, you know, they feel that we're too busy and they may be bothering, right? Or they may be imposing. So, you know, I love that you brought up sort of the compensation, service, barter, whatever it is. You'll work it out, right? These are individuals who are usually willing to help. And, you know, thanks for extending yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.